Turning now to Psalm 86 and verse 1. Psalm 86, verse 1. Bow down thine ear, O Lord, hear me, for I am poor and needy. And we're at the moment engaged in a short series of studies on extraordinary psalms, psalms that have something special and unique and distinctive to tell us. Well, this could be said, I suppose, of all psalms, but I'm sure you'll agree there are some we can select and single out as not being superior, but having some striking and individual theme which we should give special attention to. And here is a prayer of David, so it is described. And the first verse, bow down thine ear. It's David's prayer of faith. It is an extraordinary psalm because I think it would be very difficult to base your own praying upon it, and it would be quite a complex thing to do. There are many principles in prayer that we wish to remember and incorporate in our prayers, but this is such an example, and I shall try and divide it into sections for you. It's such an example of prayer that it has particular counsel to offer when we have problems in prayer. You can come to Psalm 86 repeatedly and just consider it for individual petitions and runs of petitions, because as you study them, as you look at them, they are answers to many of our problems in prayer. They will provide us counsel. The example from David's special prayer here, they will give us counsel in how to deal with different problems, putting into our mouths, into our hearts, certain petitions that really help in different circumstances. So I propose to look at the psalm in a simple expository manner and to divide it into four approximate sections. Now, before we start, I mentioned as a title David's Prayer of Faith. I'd just like to say a few words about the so-called Prayer of Faith. The Prayer of Faith is, for example, mentioned in the Epistle of James. The Prayer of Faith will accomplish great things, the raising of the sick, and so on. And it's often thought that the prayer in these days where there's been so much charismatic influence in churches, it's often thought that the prayer of faith is something along these lines. It is praying with the absolute conviction that the thing for which you pray will come to pass and God will do it, just exactly what you ask for. And it's called the prayer of faith. And it's thought, and this is quite a wrong view, but it's thought that you've got to somehow bring yourself into such a condition that you are convinced that certain things for which you pray will happen. And that will lend to that prayer special efficacy. That will make it a prayer of faith. But there is no duty in the Bible to this effect, that you have to be convinced that the prayer will be answered as you pray it, that the thing for which you specifically asked will be given you. The prayer of faith is slightly different. It runs along these lines. It means you pray with the absolute conviction that God could hear and answer your prayer exactly as you require it if he chose to do so. Faith is in God's power. Faith is in God's ability to hear and to answer. But you should be glad, we should be glad, all of us, that God will answer our prayers according to his wisdom and not according to ours. And our prayers will certainly be taken account of and answered, but in the way that God knows is the best way to respond. Best for us, best for the whole situation, will bring about our eternal and spiritual good and that of others far more than the prayer in the form that we actually offered it. And that is the prayer of faith. And as not that we're certain God will do such and such a thing, but he can do anything, and that he hears the prayers of his people. For that ye ought to say, says James, for that ye ought to say, if the Lord will. And that is the great banner over all our praying. If the Lord will, it's in his hands. So we don't want to go down the road of those in the charismatic movement who demand and claim answers from God. In breathless prayers, God has said, he will do this, he will do that, and so a specific response is claimed. That's a very arrogant way of praying. That is a manner of praying which completely overlooks God's sovereignty and his superior wisdom. We bring our petition. Anyway, I've spent too long on this, but this is David's prayer of faith. This is what is truly meant by a prayer of faith, and here it is. And the first section that we'll take is verses 1 to 4, which these verses are very much about the humility of our approach. They're just full of humility, David's approach to God. It's not claim this, claim that. It's very humble. And he opens with the words, bow down thine ear, O Lord. The bowing down of the ear of the Lord. It's a figure, of course, for God to hear in his wonderful condescension and kindness, to stoop down to us, mean creatures as we are. Bow down thine ear, O Lord. Notice the capitals for Lord there. The prayer begins with the divine name. It isn't what David always uses in this psalm, but here it is the divine name, the great I am, the all-sufficient, self-existent God, from whom all power and being flows. Bow down thine ear, O Lord. Hear me, for I am poor and needy. And the terms mean David acknowledges, well, he regards himself as poor in the sense of being distressed and needy. He lacks resources. He lacks strength. He lacks the capacity to deal with this situation. It's not possible to say exactly when this prayer was written. Was it written in the early days, while David was still being pursued by Saul? When he comes to the needs and the petitions at the end of the prayer, it could sound like that. But there are other hints in the prayer that it's from later on in his life, possibly even after his great sin, when he was convicted of his sin and descended in his heart and his experience, as it were, down to the very lowest hell of condemnation. It could be a prayer about some specific trial that he suffered, or about trials and difficulties in general that he suffered as a godly king, constantly being plotted against, and so on. So we don't know when, but bow down thine ear, O Lord, hear me, for I am poor and needy. Humility of approach. We can't expect to be heard and answered by God if we come in a self-reliant, self-sufficient manner. If we come as people convinced we can cope with this and we're good at that and we're great people and capable people, that's not King David's basis for prayer. He was endowed by God with great powers and abilities, but yet he comes with a great sense of need and a consciousness of his own inability and weakness. And that's the way to approach God, the humility of the petitioner. And it's there in the first verse. The second verse has a slight problem for us. Preserve my soul. And you can read soul in this particular verse as meaning life. That's what he asks for, the preservation of his life. Sometimes in these psalms, in fact, most often in this particular psalm, the context demands that the term soul refers to the core of his spiritual being, his soul, his spirit, but here it more likely means in this verse, his life. Preserve, save my life, for I am holy, is our King James translation. Now there's an alternative translation which is quite popular, and that is to see the word translated holy in its root sense. I am set apart or favoured, as though he has a claim upon God, not because of any righteousness of his own, but God has anointed him, shown his favour toward him. He belongs to him. Calvin thought that it should be translated, well, in French, but in English, as meek. And that David's point here is that he's going to pray to be delivered from violent men, men who are arrogant, men who are bullies, and he sees himself as being meek, in the sense that that's his calling. He had to be a general, he had to be a man of war, and a defender of the realm and a conqueror. He had to be very firm and head of the judiciary and all the rest of it, but in his own deportment and in his manner, he, even though he was a king, he wasn't someone to arrogantly throw his weight about. He sought to be a humble man and a meek man, a servant of all. And that's his commitment, and that's what God requires of him. So Calvin's view was something along these lines, that the word means, as he goes before God, I am called to be meek in manner and disposition. So my prayer is, I need special grace to deal with the bullies and the threatening people and the violent people. And that's certainly a way of putting the prayer that suits our case very often. We're called not to respond to difficult circumstances in an aggressive and in a bad-tempered way. We're called to be people of meekness. And yet, well, we are, as has often been said, as lambs among wolves. So we pray for special grace because we're not permitted to use the same violent language and deportment and methods of the world. So we feel vulnerable. But we're not vulnerable if we pray for the help of God. He will enable us to stand in the proper way no matter what's going on around us. Well, whether that's correct or whether... I think that the King James translators are going more for favoured or set apart, holy in that sense. But there is the possibility that it refers to meekness. Anyway, preserve my life, for I am holy, I am thine, set apart, or I am called to be meek. And the prayer is going to be especially against violent men. O thou, my God, save thy servant that trusteth in thee. That's his argument. What grounds have I to be heard? Lord, I trust thee. Lord, I put my hope and my trust in thee. I can't bring any argument of virtue or capability or deserving, but we trust him. So we come with this humble approach in prayer. And verse 3, be merciful unto me, O Lord, for I cry unto thee daily. Or could equally be translated, I cry unto thee all the day long. That's your marginal reading, and that's very good. Be merciful unto me, O Lord, for I cry unto thee all the day. Well, daily or all the day, we do cry, I trust, to God throughout the day. We've mentioned this very recently before. Brief prayers, emergency prayers, prayers lasting literally only a sentence or a few seconds when we have special needs and situations through the day. Things that cross our mind, people for whom we have sympathy and concern cross our mind and we utter a sentence of prayer to God for them. We do pray to him briefly and repeatedly all day long. I hope you do, whenever you can. Be merciful unto me, O Lord. This is David's plea. I trust you. I call upon thee, Lord, repeatedly. This is my cry, this is my request. And then in verse 4, part of the humble approach, rejoice the soul, surely meant of the innermost soul now, not the life. Rejoice or gladden the soul of thy servant. He asks for assurance, and perhaps he means a sense of being heard and a sense of relief in anticipation of answers to his prayer, even as he prays. We can ask for that, as David did. For unto thee, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. What a wonderful phrase and term. Do I lift up my soul? The figure is that of the priest almost, lifting up his hands with the evening sacrifice. I lift up my soul. The idol worshippers, the idolaters are going to be mentioned very shortly, and their gods in the psalm. Is that in David's mind already? He doesn't lift up some offering, some worthless offering to an idol. He lifts up his own soul to God. That is his offering. It's not a meritorious offering, but he gives it to God because it belongs to him. He gives it to God, he's coming to prayer, and he offers up only his soul, which belongs to God. He lifts it up for cleansing. He lifts it up for cheering. He lifts it up for strength, to be renewed. It's a beautiful figure. Unto thee, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. And then verse 5 brings us to another section. It's actually verse 6 is strictly the beginning, I think, of the next intended section in the psalm, because you notice verse 6 is, give ear, O Lord, capital letters again. So now the divine name is used, just like verse 1. Bow down thine ear, O Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah. And here it is again in verse 6. So I think that's the conscious start of a new section. And verse 5 is about the goodness of God and his readiness to be approached. But this is where verse 6 really takes up a new theme. The approachability of God and his responsiveness. Give ear, O Lord, unto my prayer, and attend to the voice of my supplications. I think we can put the emphasis for our purposes upon those my's. There are many people pray to God, but this is personal prayer now. Give ear, O Lord, unto my prayer, along with thy people throughout the world who are calling upon thee even as I pray. Hear me also, and attend to the voice of my supplications. And the word is strong. My entreaties might help us to see the force of it. Hear me, O Lord. It's all about God's readiness to hear individuals, the approachability of God. And verse 7, in the day of my trouble, the word in the Hebrew for trouble is tightness. And that is a kind of figure for trouble, in the day of my tightness. But some people would like to translate it anxiety. And that's good too, tightness. You've all experienced what you might describe as a kind of tightness of being. It's a kind of anxiety. In the day of my anxiety or trouble, I will call upon thee, for thou wilt answer me. Well, however God answers, he will answer, whether it will be to take away the trial, or, most likely, for his people, maybe it will be to strengthen us in a wonderful way, to go through the trial and to defend us. In the day of my tightness, trouble or anxiety, I will call upon thee. Our trouble is we don't people suffer their anxiety and they become anxious and sometimes even doubting and rash and suffer it for hours and for days and take all the burden and panic and then begin to be resentful in a time of trial or difficulty and sorry for themselves. That's us. Well, listen to King David. In the day of, he did this often too himself, but he learned his lesson. And now it seems to be his motto, prayer. Verse 7, in the day of my trouble or anxiety, I will call upon thee. One of the great I wills of the Psalms. Will you promise God that? In the day of my trouble, I will call upon thee. I will not go about miserable, anxious, snapping at people, reacting badly to situations, grumbling and groaning in my spirit. I will call upon thee. It's simple enough, but that's a pledge we can all make. In the day of my trouble or anxiety, I will call upon thee, for thou wilt answer me. The approachability of God. And David rehearses this, and he's certain of it. This is the prayer of faith. For thou wilt answer me. And then, still on the subject of the approachability and the responsiveness of God, he hasn't come to his petition yet. This is going to be quite a long prayer before he comes to the real core petition. And this is a lesson to us. If we're very anxious, you can go straight to your anxiety and call upon the Lord. You may call upon him if the matter is pressing in any order you wish. But really, we should try to take the advice of King David and follow his example. This is a good thing to prepare our hearts, and it's a very good thing to extol the goodness of God and to thank him for his approachability and his readiness to hear and to come humbly. So anyway, he's going on with approachability in verse 8. Among the gods, some people think that the gods here refers to the angels, but it wouldn't make a good deal of sense. Among the angels there is none like unto thee, O Lord, neither are there any works like unto thy works. It would be little more than a good point. But if he's referring to the gods with a small g of the pagans, the idol gods, it makes more sense and it fits other references in the psalm. Among the idols there is none like unto thee, O Lord. They have nothing like the power of God, neither are there any works like unto thy works. Those idols, they're not approachable. They're glowering idols, and constantly they have to be placated with offerings and precious things. There is none of them personal and knowable like the living God, or caring and kind. Most of the pagan gods, the concern of their worshippers is to avoid their wrath and their indignation and to buy their reluctantly given favours. There's none of them like the Lord, caring and kind and truly powerful, able to accomplish great things and freely forgiving and requiring no placation. Dear friends, neither are there any works in size and scope like unto thy works. So there's no approachability among the gods, but by contrast, the wonderful approachability and kindness of the Lord. And then in verse 9, and this might seem curious to put in here, but it fits the point. All nations whom thou hast made shall come and worship before thee. But of course, that is a prophecy. That is the calling of the Gentiles in the gospel age, in the church age. It's a wonderful prophecy, but it fits in this psalm, not only because that thought is elevating to God, but it strengthens the approachability theme. One day, oh God, people from throughout the world, from every land and nation, will find thee so approachable. It's still on the approachability theme. There's a time coming when from every nation people will find access to God and his ear and his kindness and his saving power. All nations whom thou hast made shall come and worship before thee. It's coming, says David, and shall glorify thy name, not the names of worthless idols. And verse 10, for thou art great and doest wondrous things. Thou art God alone. He reviews history. He remembers the past. He builds up his faith and his trust and his dependence upon God, even as he prays. Maybe he thinks of those future times, the call of the Gentiles. Thou art great and doest wondrous things. And that brings us to verse 11 and the third section, which runs from verses 11 to 13. And again, you notice that in verse 11, the petition is, teach me thy way, O Lord. And lo and behold, we have a third capital letters, Lord. So the divine name is used again, probably suggestive of this being intended as a new paragraph, a new section, as it were. Teach me thy way. And this section is about the promises that a praying soul, the petitioner, must make to God. So there's been a humble approach. There's been petitions about the approachability of God and his responsiveness. And now David makes his promises. When you pray, you must promise. That's what prayer is. It's a petition accompanied by a pledge. If you make petitions with no pledges, your prayers may not be effective. If you think you can come to God as a spoilt child goes to a poor and overindulgent parent, doesn't like that. The spoilt child who gives nothing and always asks, asks, asks. And the foolish, indulgent parent gives, 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 and makes the child even worse. Well, it's not like that in our relationship to God. You pray, you must pledge. You ask for great things, you must yield up your life and pledge yourself afresh. So the third section of this prayer is David's pledges and promises. Teach me thy way, O Lord, and then the I will walk in thy truth. Show me thy path. Show me how I should conduct myself. I'm open and teachable and ready to hear. Teach me thy way, O Lord. I will walk in thy truth. I'll obey. This is an undertaking, vital in prayer. You cannot go to God and say, Lord, do this for me, and I have no intention of doing that for you. Lord, do this for me. I have no intention of leaving the world and giving up my gossiping ways and reveling in earthly things and being covetous and involving myself in the wrong culture and listening to the wrong records, discs, music, whatever. I have no intention of making any move, but Lord, do this, do that, do something else. David's great lesson in prayer doesn't run like that. Teach me thy way, O Lord. I will walk in thy truth. And a wonderful phrase here, unite my heart to fear thy name. Have you wondered what that means? Unite my heart. The original Hebrew suggests a scattered heart. When do you have a scattered heart? Well, you can have a scattered heart in a number of ways. When you go to pieces, when you're all over the place, when you're worried and trying to solve your own problems in a thousand ways at once, darting here, darting there. Compose me, Lord. Draw me together. Unite my heart. Or, along the lines that I've just been mentioning, you can have a disunited heart when half of you wants the Lord and his obedience, and half of you still wants the world and your possessions and your unnecessary pleasures. And you're entitled to some pleasures, but excessive pleasures and things for yourself and your own ambitions. And these are the things that dominate you. If you're going to college, maybe you're too full of, oh, what this is going to do for you and where you're going and what you're going to accomplish. And there's a degree of importance in all that. But there's not one bit of you perhaps focusing on what you will achieve at that college for the Lord, and your stand for him and your witness and your prayers. And your heart is divided. Part of you says, I am the Lord's, and part of you says, I am also for this and for that. Unite my heart to fear thy name. Gather me together to think as one dedicated, united person, to fear thy name, to be in awe of thee and ready to obey. And verse 12. Also, it's a wonderful petition. Another I will. Many I wills in this Psalms. Here's my undertaking, Lord. I will praise thee, O Lord my God, with all my heart. Hear my prayer, and I will bring praise and gratitude and love sincerely with all my heart. And I will glorify thy name forevermore. I will live to thee and to make known thy name. Those are the undertakings and the promises. Verse 13, and you do wonder whether this was after the sin with Bathsheba and equally the terrible, terrible sin in arranging the death of Uriah, the husband. For great is thy mercy toward me. Thou hast delivered my soul from the lowest hell. What did David mean by the lowest hell? The word in the Hebrew is the earth or the grave, the lowest grave. Does he feel that in eternal punishment he would have deserved a worse punishment than anyone else for what he'd done as a professing believer and as the Lord's anointed king, to disgrace himself in that way? He wouldn't forget it. And he says here in his prayer to God, I praise thee and thank thee, O Lord, for delivering this undeserving, wretched criminal from such a deep condemnation. That's his prayer. And it's good for us to remember our sins sometimes, from which we've been delivered, just privately, not to depress our souls, but in order to revive that overflowing gratitude to God for his kindness and mercy. Great is thy mercy toward me. Thou hast delivered my soul from the worst condemnation. And then the last section of the psalm, the fourth, and this is about David's actual petition. Now he's arrived at the real theme of the prayer, the object of it. Verse 14 to the end, this will be. O God, the proud are risen against me, and the assemblies of violent men. The Hebrew word translated there violent is frightening men. So violent is a perfectly reasonable and good translation of it. Other translations would be overbearing men, forceful men, threatening men, brutal men. It all amounts to the same thing, but they're violent in some shape or form. This isn't necessarily what confronted him with the rebellion of Absalom, or much earlier on in his life with the persecutions of Saul and his military. It would fit, but it could be at almost any time in his long, long reign, when there was opposition. The proud are risen against me in the assemblies of violent men have sought after my soul. I think probably it's life in that sense here. I'd have not set thee before them. They're not at all amenable to God, going about things in a godly way. They've got a complaint, bringing it up properly. No, there's nothing divine in their conduct. They're scheming and treacherous, whoever they are. And there's a problem here. And it's true all the time for believers. Your problem may not currently be people, maybe, but it may be Satan and his demons of darkness. Perhaps suggestions made to you, you're under attack from Satan. Every time he has an opportunity dragging you down, perhaps you fall into some sin, and from that moment on, he's busy convincing you you can't possibly be a believer. You have no standing. Perhaps you're assailed with temptations that he applies to you very sorely. Perhaps your weakness is that you were a covetous person and he's bringing it back and he's putting it into your heart to want this and want that and you hate it. It's growing in you. Perhaps you were a proud person. Well, we're proud all the time, but maybe once you were insufferably proud and he's bringing it back and he's suggesting to you all the time, you're better than this one, you're better than that one, you're good at this, you're good at that. And you hate it in a sense. You like it and yet you hate it. You're under assault. And so it is here. We can adapt this prayer to our situation. In David's case, the proud are people. And the assemblies of violent men are people, but it fits equally. A spiritual or satanic assault. Verse 15, but thou, Lord, O Lord, art a God full of compassion. The attributes of God are pleaded. O Lord, I've sinned and fallen into this, but thou art a God, you can use this, dear friends, full of compassion and gracious, pardoning freely and helping freely, long-suffering and plenteous in mercy and truth. O turn unto me and have mercy upon me. Though that language there in verse 16 suggests that David had felt cut off from God. Perhaps worries had overwhelmed him and he'd lost sight or sound of the goodness and the kindness of the Lord. Because the O turn unto me implies and suggests that, and have mercy upon me, give thy strength unto thy servant, and save the son of thine handmaid. That's a very tender kind of figure. The son of thine handmaid. David says, I feel as though I'm just the son of a servant in the household. I'm a lonely and a lowly and an undeserving person. But it is the law of God that there is protection for all the children of those in the house, whether they're servants or their family. So David pleads no higher than this. I am the son of a maidservant in the household of God. Keep and protect me, O Lord, from this. He's not pleading his goodness, his achievements. And then a prayer which is special for us too, the last verse. Show me a token for good. You may ask for a token for good. When you're hard pressed, not just for you, show me a token for good that my faith may be strengthened. Well, that's all right. Show me a token for good that I may be uplifted. Yes, that's reasonable. But it isn't just for himself, David asks it. Show me a token for good that they which hate me, they who are the trouble, they who are my enemies, may see it and be ashamed. maybe they'll be saved. That the people who are my enemies may see it and realize, after all, this praying man, God has heard his prayers. And they may stand back and wonder. In the Hebrew, the word translated ashamed is pale. Pale. That they which hate me may see it and go white as a sheet. Pale. Because there's a realization dawned on them. They're in trouble. My God is there. And he has helped me. This man, this woman is remarkable. Their composure is wonderful. And they have been enabled to stand up to all that we were unleashing against them. And they have had things happen in their favour. And our attacks have been overruled. Show them, Lord. This isn't a kind of vindictive prayer. Crush them. That they which hate me may see it and pale and be ashamed, even afraid, because thou, Lord, hast helped me and comforted me. And it will be evident to them that God is at work. That's a testimony. So he asks for the token, not just for himself, but even for his enemies, to see that it may speak to them in some way and pull them up short. So that's this wonderful and extraordinary prayer of David that we may use, friends, and look at and plunder, if you wish. Humility and approach, section 1. The approachability of God, section 2. Promises made to God by us when we're praying, section 3. And not until section 4, the end, does he unfold his trouble to the Lord. Perhaps we should pray like that sometimes and not just go straight to the trouble. Dear friends, use Psalm 86. Let's close our thinking this evening, singing the hymn 5.